studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio. It's science and technology that's accessible and entertaining, and if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Scott Greenberg is out today. This morning, I speak with University of Utah geoscientist Gabriel Bowen, who joins the show to discuss new research revealing that human activity has pushed Utah's Great Salt Lake into a state unseen for at least 2,000 years. By analyzing oxygen and carbon isotopes in lake bed sediments, Bowen shows how settlement, irrigation, and modern infrastructure have fundamentally altered the lake's chemistry and water balance. Then astrobiologist Caleb Scharf joins the show to discuss his new book, The Giant Leap, Why Space is the Next Frontier in the Evolution of Life, exploring how humanity's expansion into space represents a profound new phase in the story of evolution itself. That's coming up this hour on Cool Science Radio. Stay with us. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peake. Utah's Great Salt Lake has always been a mirror of the landscape around it, reflecting every shift in climate, water, and human activity. New research shows the changes we've made in just the last two centuries have pushed the lake into a state not seen for a couple thousand years. Today, we're joined by Dr. Gabriel Bowen. He's a professor and chair of geology and geophysics at the University of Utah. His groundbreaking study uses isotope analysis of lake bed sediments to uncover how human settlement, agriculture, and development have altered Great Salt Lake's chemistry, carbon balance, and even its connection to the land. Gabe Bowen, welcome back to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Well, if you look up the work that you do, you're very heavy into isotope analysis, and you're analyzing all kinds of different things. But we know that isotopes are like little chemical fingerprints, if you will, of what's going on in the world around. But tell us a little more about how you got into this pocket of geochemistry, would you call it?
Yeah, geochemistry is good. Oh, that's really what I love about isotopes is that they are everywhere. They're in everything. And so once we start to understand how to measure them, how to read their record, their signals that they record, we can apply them to all kinds of different problems. And so that's been really the theme in my career is trying to find creative ways of using isotopes and applying them to new problems. I first got into this as an undergraduate student at the University of Michigan, wandered into a laboratory and started talking to grad students of one of my professors and, learned about isotope work they were doing and offered to help out. And one thing leads to another.
And here you are. You talk about the creative ways that you can use isotope analysis to kind of find solutions to issues. Talk about some of the other work you've done.
We have applied isotopes and kind of the same sets of ideas about how isotopes work to problems as diverse as studying sea turtle migration, reconstructing climate change tens of millions of years ago on our planet, looking at how humans have altered the water cycle through land use modification and carbon emissions. Really, in all of these cases, we can again, if we can figure out how to read the story of the isotopes, they preserve information for us to uncover.
Right. So with the information preserved, then how does it help you to go forward? I mean, if you're looking at something like, sea turtles and their migration and their patterns of laying eggs and where they lay eggs, how does that offer a solution to the future?
There's a few ways. One is we can't really make good plans for the future unless we understand the present, right? How things work today. So a lot of times what isotopes will let us do is see the unseen in our world around us today. Animal migration is a good example. Many people are fascinated by it. It's really an amazing phenomenon. And yet it's very, very difficult to observe and study directly. millions of organisms moving all over the planet, some of them very small, some large, often we're in environments that are difficult for us to access. And so tracking those animals directly is difficult, but it turns out as they move around the planet, they are accumulating their own record of their travels in their bodies in the form of the isotopes that make up their bodies. And that's what we are excited about using to detect and understand these processes. And then if we understand what's going on today, we can make better plans for the future. Isotopes also let us, in a more fundamental way, understand how chemical and climate system processes actually operate, and give us a better basis for making decisions about how we, work to ameliorate or correct or mollify changes that we're making in those systems.
So,
And
taking us to Great Salt Lake, we know Great Salt Lake is in a deep crisis. And we know that because we see the water level receding. And we know that this means lots of different things for our environment, for our air, for our snowpack. But what you're doing is you're looking at the isotope data for not just the water, but for the carbon. Is that right?
yeah, in this study, we were looking at isotopes in two different elements of oxygen and carbon. And oxygen is caught up in the water cycle of the lake, right? It's coming from the water. We were measuring it in minerals that are precipitated in the lake and end up in the sediment. But ultimately, that oxygen comes from the water. So it tells us about the water balance of the lake, how what the lake levels were essentially and how they were changing. We also looked at the carbon. Carbon, again, is coming out of the lake water. We don't think about it so much, but there's lots of carbon dissolved into all of the water around us. And that carbon, if you think about carbon, you probably think about biology. So that carbon is kind of closely caught up in the biological processes in the lake, but also in the watershed that surrounds the lake. And so by studying the isotopes and the carbon, we learn something about the ecosystem in and around the lake.
So anyone would be able to say that human activity in and around our waterways, rivers, lakes, will have an effect, much more so than before there was human settlement. And it's in a variety of ways. It's in the water that we take out of those rivers that ends up not flowing to lakes. It's in, the things we put in the water, the way our farming practices and ranching practices would influence. But the kind of study that you're doing, this biogeochemical study into it, what are your most surprising findings?
Well, I guess there's two things that we're doing here that kind of open up the box a little bit, let us see things that we wouldn't see otherwise. One is simply the time scale that we are working on, right? So we have obviously today a huge amount of interest in the lake and a lot of effort to observe and to quantify the different ways that people are impacting the lake today. That effort, that recognition, and awareness, at least in terms of the way it's being approached today in our American society, is short, right? So we don't have a very deep record of how the lake has changed over more than a few decades, really. So one of the things that's unique or different about this study is it allows us to look back in time to the time of Western settlement of the Salt Lake Basin here, and before. And so in the study, we're actually looking over a time scale of about 8,000 years to see how the lake changed as humans started to interact with it and with the environment around it in a more active way.
So Lake Bonneville is the predecessor. So what was there before Great Salt Lake? Remind us the time frame for Lake Bonneville and what it looked like. And it's pretty easy to look up on the east bench of the Salt Lake Valley and see the different levels. And you go, wow, was that really where the lake was?
Yeah, it's amazing, right? I'm sitting here in the University of Utah, and I'm a good 100 feet or so below the highest levels of that lake, right? Even though I'm up on the flank of the mountain. But so Lake Bonneville, Lake Bonneville was even earlier than the times that we're studying. So we are studying the period after Lake Bonneville had drained and evaporated away, and the Great Salt Lake had come to look more like what it does today. Hypersaline lake, saltier than the ocean by several times, and much more diminished in its spatial extent. Lake Bonneville covered something like a third of the surface area of the state. It stretched from here in Salt Lake City up into Idaho and west to Nevada and south throughout much of the dry basins that we're familiar with in this state today. And it was a giant freshwater lake. It was sustained by a different climate, by melt from glaciers that were in the mountains here. And it persisted until around 15,000 years ago, as the last ice age was coming to a close. There were a series of events, including some dramatic floods that drained a lot of water out of Lake Bonneville, and then the climate change as well that caused that lake to shrink, desiccate down to what we have today. Now, the water that's in Great Salt Lake today is not the same water that was there in Bonneville. It's not simply a residue, but as a lake, it is the remnants of what existed in this much larger state tens of thousands of years ago.
Oh, that's so interesting. The flooding, you say the flooding that drained it. And I always, whenever I go north on I-15 towards Idaho, and you see that little break in the mountains coming over from the Cache Valley, and I think I'm aware that that was part of the flooding that broke through that and drained whatever was in the Cache Valley. Is that right?
Yeah, I'm less familiar with the history of the Cache Valley. The major flood dam event that, the washout event for the Bonneville Basin as a whole was up closer to Pocatello and would have, essentially wiped away all of what is Pocatello today, along with a lot of stuff to the north and west of it. But it was a outburst flood, a flood that drained a huge amount of water out of the lake and essentially into the Snake River Valley and the Columbia River onto the ocean.
So how did the Great Salt Lake become so saline?
Yeah, how did it get so saline? What makes a body of water salty? Ultimately, the salt is coming from weathering of the rocks in the watershed that contributes water to the lake. So there's constantly a low level of dissolution of rocks, of breakdown of rocks chemically, that produces the salt, which is really just dissolved ions, dissolved atoms coming from those rocks. And that salt flows out into the water, takes it wherever it goes. The thing about the Great Salt Lake, it's because there's no outflow of water. There's nowhere for the salt to go once it gets to the lake. The water leaves the lake through evaporation, so there's a way out for the water, but when water evaporates, it leaves its salt behind. And so, the process of water constantly flowing into the lake and evaporating out leads to the accumulation progressively over time of more and more salt.
Does the salinity of the water increase the evaporation?
It actually decreases it a little bit.
Oh.
Salt in there kind of clings to the water molecules. It creates a tension that makes it a little bit harder to evaporate the water out of the lake, but obviously not enough so that it stops it.
Not enough to save it. So the observations that you've made in this most recent study of the both carbon and oxygen isotopes in Great Salt Lake tell you about human settlement over the last 200 years. What is the most groundbreaking for you? What does it tell us about how we can act in the future to hopefully save Great Salt Lake?
Well, the most surprising to me was what we saw going on with the carbon biogeochemistry of the lake. So, as I mentioned, we have these records. We took cores. We did not collect the cores. Other groups had collected them before, but essentially folks going out onto the lake, punching a hole into the sediment at the bottom of the lake. And that sediment is laid down over time, year over year, little bits of material settling down to the lake bottom. And so it creates an archive. It's kind of a tape recorder of the conditions over time. And over 8,000 years of history recorded in those sediments, we could look at the isotopes of carbon. And again, they tell us something about carbon cycle in the lake basin, the ecology, the environment, they stayed fairly constant. There was some variation in the carbon isotopes, but applying our knowledge of isotopes, we can look at that and interpret it. And essentially, what we're seeing is the lake becoming a little more biologically productive at one point, a little bit less at another. So, kind of the carbon in the lake was shifting back and forth in subtle ways, as we would expect a normal kind of natural lake to do. We saw a huge change, though, and this change happened in the mid-19th century, and it involved a shift in the carbon isotopes that told us that a lot more organic carbon, a lot more carbon from plants, was cycling through the lake. We saw this shift both in stable isotopes as well as radiocarbon, which we tend to think of as using for dating. We're using it for dating, but it also can be used in this way. Both of those were consistent in showing us more carbon from plants was cycling through the lake. In this kind of geological research, we can't conduct experiments. We're just relying on seeing one experiment that was conducted in the past and trying to interpret the evidence. So, we can't say with 100% certainty that this is exactly what caused it, but the coincidence of the timing, mid-19th century, and the nature of this change leads us to believe that what we're seeing here is the impacts of early agriculture in the Great Salt Lake Basin, changing the state of the lake system. The idea being that as folks began to settle here and colonize the basin, irrigation was one of the first things they did to put in farms to grow more crops here in the basin, pretty close to the lake, and that may have been the source of this extra organic carbon that was starting to cycle through the lake. So, fundamental and kind of unanticipated consequence for the lake's ecology, essentially, from what we're doing here in the landscape.
And then does that kind of effect accelerate as we become more and more settled and begin farming and ranching more?
It does. We see this, abrupt shift when the Western settlement first happens, but then we continue to see a progressive increase in the severity of that change. And so that's, telling us that over time, the lake has become more and more connected in some sense to the biogeochemistry of the surrounding landscape and the much more vigorous kind of active carbon cycling and nutrient cycling that we see in the valley here today in terms of our urban forest and our farms.
How many causeways have been constructed over the years on Great Salt Lake? I know in 1959 there was the railway,
Yeah.
and then but there are others too, right?
Yeah, and I honestly could not tell you how many in total. The biggest one in terms of its impact to the lake, for reasons we can discuss, is that railroad causeway. But if anybody's ever visited Antelope Island, you drive across a large causeway to get out there. There's connections to Stansbury Island. There are quite a few of these structures.
It would seem to me that that would alter a lot about the lake in a very extreme way. And it tell us how it has changed and how intense that change has been.
That's the second big signal we see in these sediment data. And this one is a little closer to home, right? It's a signal that's associated in time with the construction of that railroad causeway in 1959. The signal that we see in this case is in the oxygen. So again, the oxygen is telling us about the water cycling through the lake. And the railroad causeway that went in 1959 is a major feature, a solid feature that spans the lake from east to west, from Ogden to over near the Raft River ranges on the west side, northwest side of the lake. And one of the things it did is it created a physical barrier between two parts of the lake, the Gunnison and Gilbert Bays, which are, the two major bays today over on the west side of the lake. And when it went in, it separated those two bodies of water and it isolated the northern arm of the lake from the southern arm of the lake in terms of water exchange. And the interesting thing about this is the northern arm of the lake there has no rivers, no major rivers that bring fresh water into it. So it is essentially cut off now from all of the water cycling throughout the lake. And for folks who've seen photos or, flown over there, you can see this visually. It's really striking, the color of the water. across the causeway is like a knife that cuts across the water. It's this brilliant pink red color on the north side, and it's kind of a deep green on the south. And that relates to the microbes that live in those two different parts of the lake. But back to our story from the sediments, what we saw is that as soon as that causeway went in 1959, the sediment oxygen isotopes started to shift, and they started to shift in a way that indicated the lake was getting fresher. The water was getting fresher. Now, our samples are all from the south side of the lake. They're from the side that was not isolated from the river flow. And the signal that we're seeing there was, I think, very intuitive once you think about it, but it was a surprise to us at first because we all think about the lake getting saltier. Right? We're all worried about lake levels going down, becoming too salty, impacts to ecology, brine shrimp, et cetera. But what we saw is once that causeway went in, the lake actually got fresher, at least on the south side. And this makes sense if we think back to what we talked about in terms of why lakes are salty or why a body of water is salty. Ultimately, it involves those dissolved salts that come in the river and have nowhere to go. Well, once we put in this railroad causeway, we actually created somewhere for the salts to go. Because the railroad causeway is almost completely solid, but they put in one hole, one gap to allow water to flow out of the south arm of the lake and into the north arm of the lake, just essentially to sustain some level of lakiness, some level of water there north of the causeway. And that hole is a conduit for salt to leave the lake. It now provides a way for water to flow out of the lake, which never happened before, and into some other location, the north arm of the lake, and carry its salt with it. So it's created a new, it's kind of fundamentally changed the lake system. In our paper, we argue that the majority of the Great Salt Lake itself is no longer truly a closed basin lake with no outflows, because it does have a little outflow now to the north arm of the lake, which has kind of become in some ways, the garbage dump for the lake. It's where everything goes to die.
What causes the salt to naturally flow into that north arm through those little holes?
The salt is passive. It just goes along for the ride with the water. So anytime there's water flowing out of the south arm into the north arm, it's going to be carrying the salt with it.
Interesting. Where are the brine shrimp?
The brine shrimp are productive only in the south arm of the lake. The north arm is actually much too salty for them to survive up there. There's really no macroscopic life that I'm aware of in the north arm of the lake. It's all, just these extremophile microbes that love living in super salty environments.
So, as we look at the future of Great Salt Lake, what does something like that tell us about how it's either going to adapt, survive? Does that have an impact, having the separation there?
Well, it's actually an interesting twist, I think, in that we've inadvertently, by changing the hydrography of the lake, the way the water moves through it, we have inadvertently kind of given ourselves a little bit of an out to manage the salinity of the lake in a way that we couldn't before. This has been recognized and is actually being exploited now by managers to some degree. We, by regulating the flows out of the south arm of the lake into the north arm, we can adjust the output of salt. We can ramp it up, we can reduce it, and the water flow through it's a little more complex. There's other ways we can work with it as well. But the ultimate message is we now have a knob we can turn to dial up and dial down the salinity of the south arm of the lake a little bit as the environment changes, as the water flows change, as climate changes. We've bought ourselves a little bit of operating space. I don't want to be too rosy about it. The amount that we can manage this and what we can do with it it's fairly narrow, but it gives us more flexibility to manage the lake salinity than we had before.
Okay, and then as the water level recedes in the lake, what does this ability to manage the salinity mean for it?
So there's a lot of things, as you mentioned at the outset, that folks are concerned about. With respect to changes in Great Salt Lake, obviously the dust coming from the exposed mudflats is a great concern. But within the lake itself, one of the things that folks are most concerned about is the salinity. The salinity, again, in the south arm today, it's roughly 2.5 times as salty as the ocean. puts it in a fairly unique space, and not a lot of things live there, right? There's no fish living in the salty part of the south arm of the Great Salt Lake. But we have this vibrant ecosystem, nonetheless, that's supported largely by a small number of salt-tolerant, organisms, the brine flies, the brine shrimp in particular. And those organisms are flexible. They like living in these salty habitats. They can accommodate some change in salt, but they have an operating window. They have a window of comfort. It's like, I like it to be, within a certain range of temperature here in my office. I can deal with 5 degrees or so, but once it gets outside of that, I'm uncomfortable. And it's the same with salt for these organisms. So one of the big concerns has been that falling lake levels mean less water. Same amount of salt and less water means saltier conditions. And the concern is that we might be headed to a state where the south arm of the lake is too salty to sustain these ecosystems. And that impacts brine shrimp and brine flies, but then also the millions of birds, for example, that live in this environment and use it as a migratory stopover.
Oh, it's also interesting. It's really fun to talk to someone who has explored the history, the long history of the lake. In recent years, we talk about the future of the lake so much. We can't really talk about the future of the lake without the history of the lake, right?
Yeah, it's hard to know what you're talking about. It's hard to know what's extreme. It's hard to know what's sustainable if you can't see what has come before.
Dr. Gabriel Bowen. Gabe, thank you so much for coming back on Cool Science Radio.
My pleasure. Thanks for the great questions and the good discussion.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak. My guest this morning is internationally recognized scientific leader, author, and astrobiologist Caleb Scharf. He'll take us beyond Earth to reveal why our journey into space may be the most profound transformation since life first emerged on this planet, just as organisms once moved from sea to land and then land to sky. Humanity now stands on the edge of a new frontier, he says, one that could redefine what it means to be alive in the universe. It's all in his new and fascinating book, The Giant Leap, Why Space is the Next Frontier in the Evolution of Life. Caleb Scharf, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, thank you for joining us. It's quite a book that you have put forth here. You start off on a dismal note, I will say. We are a dying species, albeit in a billion years or so. You talk about how the evolution of life will be. There will be parallels as we explore space and as we need to explore space, because our Earth will no longer be a place that's inhabitable.
That's right. It is a slightly morbid way to start a book, but the point of it was to give a grand perspective on our existence here. And the truth is that the Earth, like any planet around any star, has a sort of finite span of time for it to be in the state that it's in. So our sun is evolving. And so in about a billion years, our sun will be brighter, more luminous, and that will change the environment on Earth. In fact, we'll probably dry out and become a sort of hot greenhouse planet, at which point it may be very difficult for life to exist. And then further down the line, in 4 billion years from now, the sun will finish fusing hydrogen in its core, and it will inflate and probably engulf the Earth altogether. And so there's this sort of grand, in this grand perspective, we talk about existential risk, but there are some things coming down the timeline that are going to be very unavoidable. And I begin the book that way to set the stage for asking, is there anything that life can do about this? Is there anything that life on a planet might find itself drawn towards to sort of avoid the inevitable, to change its future trajectory? And I would argue that learning to escape its planetary point of origin is perhaps a key piece of that.
It's so interesting because I think a lot of people don't even pay attention to space exploration. Others see it, in a sense, as billionaire's folly. And unnecessary. Why not have the perspective of Earth first? of fixing what's wrong here, but you talk about it as a biological inevitability, something that we must do to continue evolution, to continue evolving. That's really interesting and a new refreshing take.
Right. Well, you know, I wanted to tell the story of space exploration again with this grander perspective, and it led me to thinking about space exploration through the lens of natural history rather than the lens of, you know, industrial war complexes or billionaires, as you say. And that perspective is really fascinating, and I think it helps us better understand what's been happening and what is happening and what may happen. You know, the seeds for space exploration was sown hundreds of years ago as humans began to decode the physical laws of nature and gravity and forces and motion. And then, of course, the last 70 years have seen this extraordinary amount of innovation as we learned to finally leave behind the surface of the Earth. And some of those motivations were of course, more mundane. They were to do with the leftovers from World War II. They were to do with, you know, eyes on the Cold War and things like that. But I would argue there's something much deeper going on here. And it is this almost an imperative, or, you know, when life finds an opportunity, it takes it. And we see that throughout the history of life on Earth. And the opportunity to exit the Earth, to find new landscapes, to find new resources, it is a huge one. And so I think what's happening now, despite what we see with all the billionaires' goals in the news and so on, that's all part of this bigger process of expansion, of dispersal of life from one place into other places. And we know that life does that on the Earth all the time.
It's funny because you could almost say, oh, this is intelligent design.
If only it were intelligent. You know, it's, I think, the interesting thing about life as a phenomena is that it's this constant process of experimentation, all sort of sculpted by these other processes of natural selection and evolution. And so, you know, life is very good at finding new ways of doing things. And again, we see this throughout the entire history of life on the Earth. Things don't happen because life as a entity sort of foresees these things. They happen because they can't. And, you know, human intelligence is a trait, an evolutionary trait, and it unlocks new things. And one of the things it's unlocked is this capacity to lift organisms off of a planet and out into the universe.
So interesting. If you're just joining me on Cool Science Radio, I'm having a conversation with scientific leader, author, and astrobiologist Caleb Scharf. He's written a new book called The Giant Leap: Why Space is the Next Frontier in the Evolution of Life. So at the chapter heading, each of the chapters in your book, you have a quote from Charles Darwin, and you summon his work, and also you draw parallels between the voyage of Darwin's Beagle and, say, the present voyage off of this planet is all part of the evolution. So how do I like that parallel. Why did you decide to use it? It's very relevant.
I was looking for kind of a framework to think about space exploration differently. And it occurred to me that Darwin's voyage on the Beagle, this took place in the 1830s and it lasted for 5 years, was an incredible example of a planetary voyage with many, many sort of quite straightforward parallels to space exploration, to modern space exploration. It involved this very technological vessel, the Beagle, that had been heavily customized and engineered to essentially withstand a planetary voyage, but to also help its occupants, help its crew make the most of that voyage. And so Darwin was able to get really an overview of the planet in the same way that astronauts get an overview of the Earth when they're orbiting it. And that overview perspective is incredibly powerful. And it eventually helped Darwin formulate the origin of the species and his theory of evolution, which has been incredibly potent in our lives since he wrote it down. And so the other piece that parallels, I would argue, space exploration is that the ideas and the information that we gather by Being able to explore space, being able to put satellites in orbit, being able to cast ourselves further out in the solar system, those ideas and information actually in turn evolve us. And that's exactly what happened with Darwin. His ideas actually had an evolutionary impact on our species and therefore on all other species, because his ideas told us things about how we grow and breed our foodstuff. They led us to eventually the mechanisms of gene editing and the idea of DNA. And they've even led us to ideas about feedback-induced change, which are integral to modern AI. So modern AI, I would argue, owes part of itself to Darwin's ideas. Space exploration is doing the same to us. It's transforming how we engage with the world. It's transforming all of our lives. I mean, we've all ordered an Uber or used a Google Maps to navigate, or, you know, called someone on the other side of the planet. Or perhaps we've been driving down a road that was planned using satellite data to analyze where to place roads and urban structures. So it's already changing the nature of evolution, just like Darwin's ideas changed the nature of evolution.
So in the work and the research that you do, I suppose that every time you see some new advancement in AI technology and space exploration, you probably shake your head and go, yep, that's about what I would have expected. Especially looking back in this really large perspective that you have, going back to Charles Darwin and the work that he did.
Yeah, I think, you know, as a scientist and as an astrobiologist, and my day job is literally looking for signs of life elsewhere in the universe, you can't look for things unless you have a deep understanding of what they are. And the phenomenon of life, the phenomenon of us, the nature of the Earth, you know, play an enormous role in determining how we look for life elsewhere in the universe and how we plan our science. And so, yes, I think that deeper perspective or that grander perspective comes pretty easily to scientists like me, but I think it's something that we could all afford to pay a little more attention to, because it really does, it's calming, honestly. It's comforting to be able to step back and say, yeah, grander perspective, this is where we are in this extraordinary cosmos. This is what's happening. Isn't it amazing? And perhaps we can actually do something to adjust the trajectory that we're on into the future.
Yeah, so interesting. So we're pretty heavily into Mars right now, Mars exploration. And you have a chapter on Mars in your book, The Red Siren. And you, I believe what you're suggesting is that Mars may be a bit of a distraction. Why? How so?
Yeah, it may not be a very popular thing to say, because Mars has been such an iconic target of our space exploration interests. And now we're talking more seriously about getting humans to Mars and conceivably having a permanent presence of humans on Mars and so on. But the reason I call it the Red Siren in the book is that in the end, when you examine all the pros and cons for having sustained human presence on Mars and for really, you know, settling Mars, maybe even with a million people as has been suggested by some, it feels very, very daunting. Mars is weird. It's beautiful. It's austere. It's this cold desert planet. And we feel a sort of kinship with it because it looks kind of familiar on the surface. You know, it's like the South American Southwest, right? The mm-hmm. sculpted forms and so on. But that's very, very deceptive. You know, Mars has an incredibly thin atmosphere, mainly of carbon dioxide. It has serious radiation on the surface because of a lack of atmosphere. It has somewhat caustic chemistry in its soils. And on the surface, you experience a third the gravitational acceleration that you do on the Earth. Those may be very difficult conditions for humans to ever fully adjust to. And so I think in terms of, again, this grander perspective of space exploration, Mars may be a stepping stone, maybe a temporary place of interest, but the eventual future lies elsewhere for humans in space, I would argue.
Mm-hmm. In Darwin's theory of evolution, then, were there similar quote unquote distractions, stepping stones, things that may not have been the ultimate answer, but necessary to get to the answer?
Yeah, I think, you know, during Darwin's voyage on the Beagle in particular, he, you know, he was exposed to an enormous variety of environments and conditions. And he also, he got to see places where, you know, sometimes life and humans were sort of hanging on by their fingernails. And one example of this was in Tierra del Fuego, in the southernmost tip of South America, where Darwin saw the local human population seemingly in terrible conditions. And that kind of led him to think some pretty politically incorrect things about, you know, their success as a society and so on. But what we realize in retrospect, and I don't think Darwin ever quite understood this, was that, you know, those people were surviving in truly, truly appalling conditions and doing rather well at it. They'd been there for thousands of years. And so, you know, there are places like that where your initial reaction can actually distort the truth. And the deeper truth is much more interesting. It says, you know, there are ways that organisms can adapt to very extreme environments. When you see an environment in a particular moment, that's not necessarily indicative of how it will always be. And the same is true for life on Earth. Mm-hmm. We see Earth today in a very particular state. During its 4 billion years, it's been in very radically different states of climate and environment and so on.
Yeah, so what do you think are the most important tools for us to radically adapt now here on this planet? I mean, aside from space exploration, which is ultimately what you're calling for, but...
Well, I think there's a connection between what we really require here on Earth and space exploration. And that connection largely comes down to information. You know, an informed species is a species that has a chance of making better decisions. And so, you know, we've made enormous strides in monitoring the nature of the Earth's environment. And this is independent of one's views about, you know, what that environment is doing. By using satellites, by using remote sensing platforms in orbit around the Earth. Today, there's over 1,000 such platforms, such satellites. They're taking images of the Earth on a daily basis. They're measuring properties like temperature and ocean and chemistry and atmospheric chemistry and so on. And the more data we get, the better informed and the better we can understand the impact of our choices and what's coming down the pipeline. So I think most of what we need as a species into the future is better and better information. Now, of course, we have to learn how to, you know, pay attention to that information and, you know, analyze it with the scientific method and use it to reduce our ignorance about what is happening to us. But you can't even begin that process unless you have that information. And so I think the most hopeful thing for us as a species is to learn more and more and more about the nature of our existence, the nature of the Earth, the way that the biosphere engages with the rest of the planetary spheres and so on. And space is helping us do that.
Do you think, though, that in some ways now human species is becoming rather divergent in there's one path that is advancing science, that is using technology, that is becoming more informed, is changing the way that it lives based on the science. And there's another contingent that's going, you know, it's growing and it's going the other way. It's denying science.
There does seem to be that kind of dynamic taking place. I try to remind myself that we've been here before at many points in human history with very divergent worldviews and, you know, challenges between what many of us would consider to be rational, information-based, fact-based thought and decision-making that is based on other things. You know, what is different today is that there are many more humans than there have ever been. some 8 billion of us, our impact on the world around us has never been greater. So yeah, these points of divergence happen. I don't know if that will ever change for us. It may be part of the sort of recipe for humans, is that you have a spread of thoughts, spread of ways of thinking, and sometimes that sort of bifurcates, it splits into these noticeable groups. Sometimes it merges together. You know, in the end, though, I guess maybe I'm too much of a pragmatist, but I feel that in the end, most people want food, they want housing, they want a safe and reasonable life, they want to feel secure, they want their family to do okay. And, you know, over history, that does tend to draw us back to a certain amount of sanity. On the average, the danger is when the pendulum swings and, you know, we've been reasonably lucky so far. We didn't engage in thermonuclear warfare in the last, you know, 70, 80 years. We kind of drew back from that. There are other things going on today, for example, the surge in AI. And I think that story is yet to be fully understood. That has the potential to be very destructive and to amplify this divergence that we can feel within our own population. You know, we'll see what happens with that.
Your book, The Giant Leap, it's just so interesting. And I find it very accessible. You don't have to be a scientist to read it. So who is your audience, and what do you hope for your audience?
Well, I'm really happy to hear that it seems accessible. The audience is broad. Part of the audience are those who are already space enthusiasts, and I think the book should appeal to everyone in that audience. But I wanted to really get to a much broader audience of people who, you know, read the newspaper, listen to the news, and understand that there are things going on around them, particularly things in space. We hear about, you know, companies like SpaceX progressing its rockets and launching more and more satellites. You know, I want the book to be there to inform people who want to be better educated about these things, to make decisions in their own lives. So what does this mean? What does it look like? What is space exploration really about? Because I think you said at the beginning of this conversation, many of us are sort of oblivious to it. We're sort of aware that stuff is going into space, but we don't stop to think about what it's doing, what the implications are. So the book is for those of you who want to be better informed, those of you who want to make better decisions about, you know, where do you put your money, about how do you see the future going. That's who the book is for. But it's also, I think, such an interesting and fun and exciting story of something positive that our species has done, which is learn how to take this extraordinary journey into the universe around us.
Yeah. We did an interview with a local startup. And when I say local, I mean Park City, a small town with lots of incredible expertise, I will say, but a startup that was talking about the commercialization of the moon. And I found it so fascinating that there was actually a viable business happening. And so I guess my question here is, what types of efforts and exploration should we give the most credence to, or the most support of, or if we're investing our dollars, you know, where this isn't an insider trading question, I promise, but where do you think we should really be focused?
It's a great question. I think there are two sides to this. There's the scientific side and scientific exploration, and companies, startups contribute to that by providing flight hardware, that providing rockets, providing the spacecraft bits and pieces that you need. And that's happening at an increasing rate. And it's because of the way that, for example, the United States invests in its space program and its calls for, you know, innovative technology to help support that program, make it more efficient. But then there is this emerging space economy. And I think that if you want to put your money somewhere, that's probably where to put it. This emerging space economy, which is attached to these sort of national interests, not just of the US, but of Europe, of China, and so on, in going to places like the moon. because of the technological development that can take place, but also because of a much longer term vision for a space economy where we are gaining resources from elsewhere. Maybe it's on the moon, but it may be from things like asteroids that can contain enormous amounts of precious metals and rare earth elements and so on. And all of that requires infrastructure. And it's like building, you know, the railway network in the United States or building a network of airlines that take cargo and people around the world. We're seeing the beginnings of that infrastructure. And this is why companies are getting in on it, because the space economy could exist on a scale completely unprecedented to anything else on the Earth. We're talking about an economy not measured in billions or even trillions of dollars, but in quintillions of dollars, of course, spread across a vast landscape in our solar system. And I think we're beginning to see that really happening. One small statistic is that we're getting very close to a point where there will be a rocket launch every single day from somewhere on the Earth into space, placing something into space. That has never happened before. Something is afoot.
Yes. Well, Caleb Scharf, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for joining me on Cool Science Radio. And I just wanted to ask you before I let you go, you are currently the senior scientist for astrobiology at NASA's Ames Research Center. So what do you all do there?
Ames is actually basically NASA's oldest center. And it sits in Mountain View, California, in Silicon Valley. It's right next to Google and Apple and all those other places. Ames has been there really since the inception of NASA. NASA has multiple physical centers around the country. Some are flight centers, where they really, really focus on spacecraft construction. Some are research centers, and Ames is a research center. And it has a long and rich history of work in aerospace, in computing, and in science. And it played a role in the early exploration of the solar system. And now it plays a role in things like lunar exploration by building devices like the Viper lunar rover that we hope to get to the moon sometime soon, thanks to SpaceX. And of course, science. And so we're deeply engaged in fundamental science that feeds into all of NASA's programs.
Again, the book is The Giant Leap, Why Space is the Next Frontier in the Evolution of Life. My guest is Caleb Scharf. Caleb, thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio here on KPCW. You can find this episode on kpcw.org under the Shows tab or on the KPCW app or wherever you get your podcasts at KPCW Cool Science Radio. And if you liked today's episode, rate us, subscribe to the show, and share it with your friends.